This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 89th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have today with me Mike Ryder. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm good. Mike Ryder is a distinguished professor of computer science at UNC. His research ranges widely in computer and communication security and distributed computing. Before joining the UNC faculty, Mike worked at AT&T Bell Labs, NCR, Lucent, and CMU, where he was founding technical director of Scilab. He moved to UNC in 2007. Dr. Ryder is an ACM fellow, and he holds a BS in math from UNC and an MS and PhD in computer science from Cornell. And Mike lives in North Carolina. I'm not even sure which city, Chapel Hill, presumably?
That's correct.
Okay. So you've had a long and distinguished career in both corporate research and in academia. So I'd like you to compare and contrast academic research and corporate research and how that went for you.
Oh, great question. So I do this for my students sometimes when they're getting ready to graduate because they're trying to decide what sort of jobs to apply for. Mm-hmm. And what I usually tell them is that the jobs are more different than it may appear from the outside. Hmm. And what I mean by that is that in corporate research, I found that there was far less context switching in terms of the projects and so forth that I was paying attention to on any given day. So, for example, even as a director in Bell Labs, there would be entire days where I could sit down and write code.
Right.
Whereas as a professor who's overseeing the projects of, say, 6 to 8 grad students and managing a couple of other collaborations with other people, my day is driven by context switching from one issue on some project to another issue on another project.
Right. So danger of thrashing, but also lots of interest.
Yeah, it's fascinating because you certainly never get bored. And if you get stuck on one project, there's another project that needs your attention anyway. So you go pay attention to that one.
Don't let your students know that.
Right, exactly. But the there is a risk of thrashing. And a lot as a professor's job is also as much about, I would say, guiding the research as it is doing it, or it's even more about guiding the research than it is doing it themselves, it seems like, because, of course, the graduate students and maybe postdocs, if you have them, they have these long periods of time where they can focus on the problem, but I'm, again, hopping from one thing to another.
Right, right. And they're supposed to be learning how to do research as well.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, I tell students that I know they're ready to graduate with their PhD when I'm just asking questions to keep up.
And I like that. That's good.
Yeah.
Is there any difference in terms of the nature of the work, of the kind of work that you're that you were working on in both places, or is it pretty much similar computer security research?
Well, I was fortunate to be in industrial research in Bell Labs when that research was still allowed to be pretty fundamental in nature.
Right.
And what I mean by that is that over time, Bell Labs, just like many other labs, have changed the degree to which they appreciate fundamental research in comparison to marketable research.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've sort of heard tell that one of the reasons for that is, of course, AT&T, when the labs was in its heyday, was a monopoly. And so they were sort of justifying their monopoly by saying, well, we're so good, we're investing all this in basic research.
Right. I think there's some truth to that. I guess another way to put it would be that a company can afford an expensive research labs. Mm-hmm. While it has a monopoly or is in a very dominant position in its industry. But once its margins start getting impacted significantly by competition, they need to find places to save money. And research is a cost center that that pays off in the long term, but they may need that savings in the short term.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk about that. I mean, what have you learned, both positive and negative, about commercialization and tech transfer over the years?
Well, I guess on the, let's see, I don't know if I would call it the negative side, but it's hard to call this a positive. It's harder than one might initially think.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried, certainly when I was in industry, in Bell Labs, we tried to engage business units from within research and transfer technologies to their organizations. And I've also tried a startup once in academia that, and I'm happy to tell that story, but the short version is that it didn't go very far.
turned out academics are academics.
That's right. But in both cases, it's somewhat challenging. And in part, I think it's because when we're trying to do what I would call more academic research or fundamental research, we're far less focused on the time horizon at which this is going to be useful, sort of marketable or demanded. And so, you know, in Bell Labs, we would try to approach the, say, the product units with an idea, and they already have their plans laid out for the immediate future. They're short on resources already for the plans they have laid out. Mm-hmm. And the prospects of thinking about a new direction, the newness of the direction that they're willing to consider is really quite small.
Right, limited by their current position.
Exactly, yeah. And let me be very clear, I'm not faulting them for that. I mean, they're just under a very different set of pressures than, say, your typical researcher would have been. Mm-hmm. A much more realistic approach, I think, to transferring technology is to, in industry, at the time at least, was to engage the product groups on their problems, not with your ideas. So come to the product groups, try to help them solve a specific problem that they're addressing, and once you've sort of earned your bona fides with them, then try to incorporate some new directions that you think might be beneficial for them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other thing, too, is it's very easy as a researcher to approach a domain in which they're working and think you understand it, when in fact you really don't. I mean, I've done this a million times in my career where I thought I understood a problem, but then when I talk to the people in the trenches, I realize I really don't understand their problem at all.
Right.
And so, you know, it's more than just going and working on their problems to sort of earn your credibility with them, but it's also important to go work on their problems so that you actually have the context you need to think about things that will be useful to them.
Right, right. Even in applied research in science, the sort that we were doing at Cigital a million years ago, it still takes 10 years to get stuff commercialized. And, you know, that's a lot of patience to get it way out there, it used in the world by lots and lots of people.
Right, right.
Which invention of your own or research project of your own has the most interesting story along those lines?
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I mean, I can tell you lots of stories of interesting failures.
That's fine.
And I can also give you a couple of maybe novel success stories. I don't know. So I will tell you about the startup we tried.
Okay.
And it was a lesson in as much in how you go about a startup as it is in the particular technology in which we attempted to do the startup. The technology that we were working with, this was a collaboration with a colleague who is still at Carnegie Mellon. His name is Leo Bauer. And we together tried a startup on some mobile technology that we had developed. And I think, to make a long story short, the mistake we made in doing the startup was that we tried to stay academics, have positions in the company, but really have someone else run the company.
Yeah.
Because we didn't want to leave our academic job.
Yeah, and it turns out you have to live when you're in the startup when you're doing a startup.
Exactly. And I didn't really appreciate that before this whole experience. And so what we found was that while we could do things for the company, ultimately we didn't control its trajectory, and there ended up being differences of opinion with the folks who did control its trajectory, and so it didn't work out.
Right.
And so the lesson there is, if I ever do a startup again, I'm going to go to the startup.
Yeah, you go full in. Yep.
You're right, exactly. You say live it.
And it will eat your life, too. When there are only three or four of you, or seven, as the case may be, you wear a lot of hats.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you think we've made progress in the last 5 years, more progress in network security or software security?
In the last 5 years, I think I would say software security. That would be my best guess, attempt at answering that question. Because, and I say that in part because I think a lot of the innovations that have impacted network security, I tend to think of them as arriving on the scene a little bit prior to the last 5 years.
Right. Yeah. I was kind of wondering about that. I mean, there certainly has been a ton of change in network security since, say, the mid-90s.
That's right.
An absolute ton. But it seems like right now, maybe innovation-wise, there's more juice behind software security for whatever reason.
Well, I think part of it is that I don't want to paint the picture that networks are simple in any sense. I mean, they're obviously highly complicated and hard to make secure. But there are natural, say, choke points at which you can do certain things to try to crudely block out, you know, different kinds of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in software systems, it's I guess there are some natural choke points you can think in terms of, but the complexity seems a little bit more difficult to harness, and so I think a lot of the advances have been a little bit slower to come along in this space, but I think, you know, the field has made some remarkable and is making some remarkable advances in this space.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about teaching a little bit. You've been teaching security for years, including a course this semester at UNC on the Introduction to Computer Security. What is your approach? What approach do you generally take?
Yeah, so, you know, it depends a lot on the level at which the course is being taught.
Yeah.
So, you know, this semester is an interesting one because it's an undergraduate class.
Total noobs. Can they code?
Well, so what I was going to say was that the variety of backgrounds in the class, it just... huge.
Yeah.
The differences that these in the backgrounds that these students have, and so coming up with projects for them to do that appeal to all the students in the class is really a challenge.
I bet it is.
And so, you know, that's what I was meeting with my teaching assistant today about, was how are we going to develop or you know, find labs.
Have you taught
that work well.
Intro before, or is this your first whack at it?
Well, I I've used some of the material from this class in previous classes, uh-huh. But I kind of think of this as a revamping of the class.
Right.
Now. So I am going to be restructuring it. I'm going to be developing, I would say, maybe 30 to 40% of the content anew.
Uh-huh.
So it is kind of a new class. But yeah, there are a lot of challenges. I also have a substantial number of students, so I think we're topped out at 40-something students.
That's plenty.
Well, you know, for some universities, that's not a huge number, but for computer science here at UNC, we're kind of a smaller department, and that is a pretty big class for us.
Yeah. Well, it's a sexy topic, right? Everybody's like, ooh, well, I want to learn that. That'll give me a good job.
That's true.
So, kind of related to the teaching thing, do you think that you can teach kids to think like a bad guy, Should you? Do you have to do that?
Great question. This is something I debate with myself every time I teach a class in sort of like this. Is, you know, the easiest labs to put together or to find for the students to do are typically attack labs.
Right.
So, hey, code up this kind of buffer overflow or do this kind of attack. And it's a bit of a shame because it seems to, I mean, while it's important for the students to appreciate how to do or how these sorts of attacks get done, it's not what they're going to be asked to do, hopefully, when they leave the university and go to work for a company.
Well, some people have to do that, but not most.
Yeah, I would say not the average, right? The average would be they're going to some software development job and so forth, and hopefully they're not actually coding buffer overflows as part of that, right?
If they're working for us, they might be.
That's true. For you, you're a different story, but I think from your typical company, perhaps not. And I've always feared that there's a bit of a missing the forest for the trees problem here, that if you teach to particular attacks, then they think that defending those attacks is what security is about.
Exactly, yep.
Kind of not.
Yep.
It gives you a perspective of what some kinds of attacks are, but if you really want to teach principles of secure system design, it's important to come at it from a different angle. So I do try to come at it from a different angle in my class, but like I say, when it comes to the particular homeworks and projects, you know, sometimes I do fall back to some of the standard attack projects, which
right.
Over time I'll build up some others. But for now, you know, I would say a number of my projects this semester will be attack projects.
You could do code review, you know, maybe some use find bugs on a Java, simple Java thing or something like that.
Right.
What's the hardest thing to try to teach in computer security in your experience?
The hardest thing to teach is principles as compared to technologies.
Uh-huh. Big ideas and how those affect engineering.
That's right. Yeah. So if you want to teach students particular technologies that they can use in their day job when they get out and get hired by, you know, company X and so forth, that's fine. But what's going to happen on the project that they come to where it's a pretty foreign environment to them, or they need to adapt a lot.
Yeah, or there's a new tech stack or something like that.
Exactly. And if they don't really know the principles to fall back on, then they might be at sea for a while, I expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I try to do in my classes is distill out some principled ways of dissecting problems so that I almost trying to teach them how to think about security as opposed to teaching them how to do security.
I really like
that.
And
I know that. Yep. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. But
I think it's a great thing, but it's a difficult thing.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I've succeeded by any stretch, but it is something I try to do.
So you've grown 13 new PhDs with 6 more in the hopper. What's become of your students, your PhD students?
Well, so I should go look up where they are. I think 5 of them are at Google.
Wow.
Google's been a huge employer for security people.
Uh-huh.
And distributed systems people for sure, because that's where where I spend some of my time.
Right.
I have a couple of students who've gone to Akamai. I have 2 students at RSA Labs, and 2 students at universities.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think how many I'm up to now.
So all over the place.
Oh, and yeah, and then I have 1 student in a kind of a startup company that's existed for 2 or 3 years.
Right. So yeah. What kind of advice do you have for undergrads that are thinking about graduate work in security?
Well, I do try to encourage it because I think there's a huge demand, not only in the U.S., but worldwide, for people with advanced training in this space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at projections about the number of jobs we're going to need in this space compared to the number of advanced degrees in this area that we're producing, there's a shortfall. Mm-hmm. In this country, there's a shortfall.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of several very large efforts in other countries to sort of huge centers at big universities in security specifically, as evidence that even in other countries there's a huge demand. So, you know, I think it's a fascinating area to work in. I think the job prospects are very good for people with advanced degrees in the future. And so I strongly encourage it.
Are there it's not for certain everyone. Courses of undergraduate work that you tell kids to take?
Well, so certainly for those that will be pursuing advanced degrees, I think there's a number of topics that are very important to understand that I think sometimes get short shrift. And I tend to think towards some of the more theoretical topics that underpin computer science. And part of my thinking on this might be influenced by where I came from, because I was, as you said, a math major as an undergraduate, and then I went to Cornell, which historically had a pretty theoretical department.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And
still does.
Well, I think it still does to an extent, or at least I would say theory is well represented, though I would say that they've also done a great job in the last decade in expanding their systems abilities as well. But mm-hmm. when I was there, which was much more than a decade ago, it was, you know, still perceived as a very theoretical department, and certainly we got a lot of theory when we were there. And frankly, I think it served me very well, even though I wouldn't call myself a theoretician.
I totally agree with you. You know, we had to take absolute tons of theory at Indiana, where I was, in computer science for whatever reason, and it's incredibly useful.
Yeah, it really is. So I don't regret those days at all. I think they were remarkably well spent.
Uh-huh. So, kind of a thing from left field, what do you think we can do to attract more women into this field?
Well, it's a very important question. You know, I've been pained for many years by the fact that our field doesn't seem to appeal to half of the brains on the planet. That is the female half. It, you know, I have to believe it hurts our field tremendously.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if I knew how to explain it, you know, I'd be doing more to try to help. I mean, I think one thing that I saw a fantastic talk by a professor at the University of Virginia who had done a study on retention rates for women in computer science graduate programs.
Mm-hmm.
And the critical mass of women was the most significant factor in their retention rates.
Right. So just having enough people there that are your peers, like
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer in that we need to get more women into the ranks of faculty in the departments so that there is a growing presence of women, and then once women are here, doing, you know, what we can to make sure that they're not feeling left out in some fashion.
Right.
You know, I did participate in a Women in Science program here at UNC at the end of the spring semester. Now, this wasn't specific to computer science. This was for all sciences on campus. And I signed up, and I was one of two guys who showed up mm-hmm. at this otherwise all-women event. And they had these great panels about, you know, for women from different fields.
I bet you learned a lot at that thing.
I learned a tremendous amount. And one of the things that allowed me to learn the most was that during one of the panels, one of the panelists was talking about, in this case, in the field of physics, how she had been given a lot of signals about, you know, she really shouldn't be here. I mean, they weren't overtly saying this, but she was feeling treated that way.
Right.
And so I raised my hand and I said, hey, look, in computer science, we have the same problem I think physics does, maybe even worse. What are we doing? What are the guys doing? What are these signals? And you wouldn't believe the number of constructive pieces of feedback I got about that. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's... you know, the women were coming up to me after this panel session ended explaining sort of what they're talking about.
Right.
And these are things that really hadn't occurred to me.
You should write it down. Share it.
You know, I could, and I would love to, but I would almost rather them write it down in the sense of because I would be the sort of the I would probably mess up the stories.
No,
anyway.
But you know, a sort of male perspective, we're the problem in some sense.
Yeah, well, so, right.
So how we can get past that would be very, very useful, I think, for a lot of departments, and a lot of people.
Right. But you know, I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's an important problem, and I think the more we think out loud and talk about this, hopefully somebody will come up with a great idea of what to do with it.
Right. A couple more questions. My researchers had a really tough time finding out much about you outside of your official position. You're pretty darn well hidden on the interwebs. So what interest do you have outside of computer security? I mean, I really couldn't find anything.
Well, yeah, it's. I guess I'm not a big social networker. I mean, I do have a Facebook page, but you know, it's.
Oh, I didn't even look on Facebook.
But you know, I guess that's one reason there's not a lot about me out there. So, in the last few years, I've gotten into mixed martial arts.
Oh, cool.
And so I spend a few nights a week going to a place and getting beaten up. My students have stopped asking why I'm so bruised.
Right.
Because they know the answer.
Right.
And, you know, it just means I need more practice, apparently.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But that's been one thing I've picked up, and I am now the campus advisor for the Mixed Martial Arts Club on campus.
Oh,
so
cool.
I try to, you know, help out or at least enable them to do their thing.
Yep.
Here on campus.
Sure beats poking plastic keys all day.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I like lots of sports. I'm also very, you know, I have fun watching my daughter, you know, in her interests. So I have a teenage daughter, and she does some neat things. And so just being a dad.
Cool.
Keeps me busy too. Yeah.
Cool. See, I didn't even know that. That's pretty well hidden. Maybe not on Facebook. I guess I should get a Facebook account.
I see. Oh, see, you're smart enough to not even have an account.
I got on it once to hook my band up so that it would automatically post from the blog to the Facebook account, and that was it. That's the only time I've ever logged in. I used somebody else's credentials.
Got it.
Yep. So, last question. I'm a huge fiction reader. Just read 7 books at the beach, including a new one by one of my favorite authors, T.C. Boyle. What's the last book you've read lately? Doesn't have to be fiction, but.
Well, I was going to say, as soon as you started that sentence, I got this fear, right, that, oh my gosh, he's going to ask you what my latest fiction book is that I've read. And you know, with the reviewing I do for conferences and so forth, it's really
some of that's fiction.
I don't have time. I'm so well. Some of them are. That's true, and those get rejected, I guess. But let's see. So the latest book I read substantial parts of. Yeah, I have been consulting a particularly good book written by Gita Tia and Jennifer Welch on distributed systems. Now, this is not so much in security, but sort of on the distributed systems side. They have a great distributed algorithms book, and I've been pulling a lot from that lately. So I guess that would be the one I've consulted the most as of late.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thank you for your time today. It's been a really interesting conversation.
Hey, Gary, I really appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to you coming to visit.
See you soon.
All right.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P includes a Silver Bullet interview with Visa CSO Gary Warzala and features articles from Fred Schneider, Dan Gear, and Becky Bass, among others. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.